I will call the meeting to order and entertain a motion for the minutes of January 13th.
Madam Chair, I would like to move the minutes.
Representative Benson moves the minutes of January 13th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. I think that today we have there's hearings and then there are hearings. And I think that today's hearing is one that will be a big picture hearing where we can really examine what are we going to do this session, how big do we want to think, what kind of shape are we in for education. We have a huge deficit, and does that mean that we, you know, hunker down, or does it mean that we continue to think big about education? We just heard the governor's ideas that even in times of need, he's proposing increased revenue here. And we haven't seen the whole budget to see how we feel about where it might be coming from. But for the luxury of just this committee, we're only looking at just this budget. And so we have some big picture people here today to talk to us about the big picture investment in education. And the first one is the Minnesota Budget Project. If you could come up. We have Nan Madden here, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Budget Project, and they have done some research on what the investment in education has looked like for the last decade. And so we'll ask her to present. Then we also have Angie Eilers from Growth and Justice, and Tom Stinson, our state economist, who talked to most of us yesterday if we were at the Humphrey Institute. And he talked in general, but we'll have him just zero in on education today. And it's my intention to have discussion in between each speaker. So if you have a question, let them finish their presentation, but you can signal our staff if you think of a question so you can get on the list. And then we'll take, we'll divide the time so that we have equal time for all the presenters or thereabouts. And but we'll have as much discussion as possible. So, Ms. Madden, welcome to the committee, and we look forward to your presentation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm really happy to have the opportunity to meet with you today and share the findings of some recent research that we've done called The Lost Decade. And I think you all have a copy of this report. It's got a blue cover. Again, my name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. The Minnesota Budget Project is an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues, with a particular emphasis on the impact of fiscal decisions on low and moderate income Minnesotans. So in our Lost Decade report, we took a look at the state's responses to fiscal challenges over the past 10 years, and we asked whether the state has been maintaining its commitment to public investment. We believe that state investments have a role to play along with the business community, the nonprofit sector, and Minnesota residents in building a state with a high quality of life in which all people have the opportunity to succeed. So in our report, we took a closer look at state investments in four areas: K-12 education, higher education, child care assistance, and affordable housing and homelessness prevention. And we looked at what the state funding trend has been in those areas from the 2000 to 2009 fiscal years, what were some of the policy choices that influenced that funding trend, and what the implications have been for Minnesota's quality of life and whether everyone has access to opportunity. So overall, we found, looking at the state's general fund, spending has increased 5% over that 10-year period over inflation. All of the numbers I'll give today and that are in the report that talks about changes in spending over time have been adjusted for inflation. In all but one of the areas we studied, we found that the state's general fund investment is expected to be lower in 2009 than it was in 2000, and lower by a substantial margin. K-12 education was the exception, in that, but even so, it joins the other three areas in showing a decline in funding since 2003. An indicator suggests that this decline in investment has meant there are serious consequences for the well-being of Minnesotans and whether all Minnesotans have the opportunity to succeed. Now, just a quick note about our data. In this analysis, we looked at general fund budget data that comes from the Minnesota Department of Finance. I guess I have to get used to calling them Minnesota Management and Budget now. And as I said, we adjusted the information for inflation over time. Our fiscal 2009 numbers are those from the budget passed last year, so we have not adjusted those either for unallotment or any other changes that might be made this year for the fiscal 09 budget. I think it's important to keep in mind what the big picture was for the state's budget over this 10-year period. And we put together this graph that shows for each legislative session whether the state was experiencing a surplus or a deficit in the general fund. And in that graph, the black bars were the balance in the current biennium, so whatever biennium was current in that legislative session, and the blue bar is the projected balance for the next biennium. And you'll notice, unfortunately, that the deficit years outnumber the surplus years. We started this decade with 2 years of projected surpluses, and those were the last two of a five-year period of surpluses. Just over half of the surplus dollars available to the legislature at that time were used to reduce taxes through permanent tax cuts and rebates. This was followed by deficits in the 2000 through 2005 legislative sessions, and the solution to those deficits relied heavily on cuts in spending, with particularly large cuts occurring in 2003, as many of you experienced. We had 2 years of surpluses, and now we're back to deficits again. And because we did this chart last year, it does not include the $4.8 billion deficit we're facing in this legislative session. During this decade of declining investments in most areas of the state's budget, there was not less of a need for those investments. In fact, the opposite case could be made, as this is a time span in which Minnesotans were struggling economically, even when the economy officially was in a recovery. I'm going to put up just two quick statistics about what happened during this time span we're looking at in terms of Minnesotans' well-being. And you'll see that most Minnesotans just did not gain ground during this decade economically. And in fact, as a state, we lost ground in terms of our poverty rate and the median household income. So we'll take a closer look now to our findings in terms of B12 education, because I know that's the interest of this committee. Our big picture findings, state general fund investments in B12 education over this 10-year period are up 10% after adjusting for inflation. But many of you know, a lot of that reflects a shift in spending when the state took over responsibility for funding a portion of education in the reform legislation passed in 2001. Since the 2003 fiscal year, the state's general fund investment in education has declined, and there has, as a result, been a greater reliance on local property taxes to fund our schools. We also find that over this time period, Minnesota has become a more average state in its commitment to education funding. So I'll talk about those points in a little more detail here. This graph is the state's general fund investment in B12 education. And as I mentioned, overall, if you compare from 2000 to 2009, it's up 10% after adjusting for inflation. But that increase primarily occurred in fiscal 2003. As I mentioned, in 2001 legislative session, the state passed a funding swap, which the state took over about $1 billion in education funding and reduced local property taxes by a similar amount. So that wasn't an increase in total revenues for schools necessarily, but instead a shift in who was paying the bill. And the first year that was fully in effect was fiscal 2003. But of course, the state soon faced large budget deficits, and since fiscal 2003, the state has not really kept up with that increased commitment. So if we compare from 2003 to 2009, we see a 12% decline in funding. I mentioned that the state overall made deep budget cuts in 2003. the 2003 legislative session. And while education fared a little bit better than some other areas of the budget at that time, some of the areas that were cut in the E-12 education budget were places where we helped those students who are struggling the most and already are facing the largest challenges. So we capped funding for students with limited English proficiency. We eliminated funding for after-school enrichment programs, which help at-risk youth. And we cut adult basic education by about 11%, and that serves adults and youth with English as a second language, citizenship, and GED completion. Now, state funding is an important funding source for schools, but not the total picture. So this graph here looks at total school district revenues per pupil. And if you take a look at the darker blue section on the bottom, that's state aid, so you'll see that kind of similar pattern as the last slide where there's a bump up in 2003, followed by gradual decline. The light blue portion on top of that is school property taxes, and they have been increasing since 2003 to make up for the decline in state funding. So since fiscal 2003, per pupil state aid to school districts fell by 14%, and school property taxes per pupil are up 47%. There were some modest increases in other revenue sources as well, but they were not enough to fully offset the decline in state funding. Total school district revenue per pupil fell by nearly 5% from 2003 to 2009. I think we have 3% in the report, but we've gotten some updated data that suggests the overall decline is closer to 5%. We think the greater reliance on local property taxes raises two important questions. Are we raising our educational funds fairly, since property taxes are a regressive funding source where low and moderate income people pay a larger share of their income for that? And do students in districts with low property wealth have the same access to quality education in children in more well-off districts? As Minnesota has failed to maintain its commitment to education funding, it has fallen behind other states as well. So on this slide and in the report, we make a comparison between Minnesota and other states in two ways. The first is education spending per pupil, and then the second is education spending as a share of personal income. So in terms of education spending per pupil, Minnesota was nearly 11% above the national average in 1987, and in 2006, we were equal to the national average. In terms of measuring as a share of income, and that represents the state's investment in education compared to our overall ability to fund it, in that measure, again, Minnesota was about 10% above the national average in 1987, but in 2006, we were nearly 10% below the national average. So while in the past, Minnesota clearly was above average in terms of its investments in education, that is no longer the case. Now, a decline in spending might not really matter that much if we were still getting the outcomes we expect and want out of our education system. So we actually, in our report and across all four areas studied, we are asking whether the indicators suggest at this lower level of investment, what has been the outcome in terms of Minnesotans' well-being, and do all Minnesotans have the opportunity to succeed? And here we find the data is very troubling. And this is not a surprise to anyone on this committee, but Minnesota is not ensuring that all children have the opportunity to succeed, and in fact, we have some of the largest racial and income disparities in educational achievement. So we rank dead last in graduation rates of black students among the 37 states that consistently report that information, and we also lag significantly behind the national average in graduation rates of our Hispanic, American Indian, and Asian students. These young people are our workforce of tomorrow, and we're concerned that our future economic competitiveness as a state is at risk when we have so many Minnesota children who aren't reaching their full potential. Now, we know that as legislators, you are facing an extremely serious challenge this session as we confront this large budget deficit. And I think one of the lessons we take from the analysis in this report is that we face that deficit in a fundamentally different position than, for example, where we were in 2003. You're going to be considering budget cuts to key areas of investment that have already been eroded and have not recovered from the last round of cuts. And we also know that we're in a recession. That means a greater need for state services and a greater understanding, I think, of the need to make those investments that build a strong economy. But Minnesotans are entering this recession in a worse economic position than they were at the low point of the last recession. So this analysis indicates that Minnesota is not making the investments needed in order for all Minnesota students to have the chance to succeed. And we're concerned that the choices that will be made to address the state's current budget problem are only going to make that situation worse. As a result, we will be making it more difficult to have a high-quality workforce and the kind of economy that we'll want to see in the future. So thank you, and I'll take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Madden, very much. Questions? Representative Hepsey.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I had a question. You had mentioned in the report, I think it was on page the school revenues per pupil, I think on that page where we talked about that your concern is that we're paying up 47% in our property taxes, and the concern that you have is that the students that are, do not have access to the property wealth districts are the ones that are spending money on their children, and that there might not be enough money left over from the property poor districts. Educate me on that, in that I thought that this is the Minnesota Miracle, and I know we have a Minnesota Miracle too that's coming out, but it's my understanding we haven't, that the wealth of the district as far as funding is concerned is not based on the property tax values, because there is equalization that goes on. And could you explain to me, has that equalization significantly changed? In other words, has the percentages of what the property wealth districts are sending to the property poor districts, has that changed in recent years?
I'm Madden.
Representative and Madam Chair, I'm going to answer that question in a more general way, and I'm also going to ask Jeff Van Wyken, who's a consultant who worked with us on this report, whether he knows about the more detailed question you're asking about equalization. The point that I was trying to make is that as we are having more of school funding funded through voter-approved referenda, that it is more difficult for low-wealth districts potentially to pass those referendums, and if there's more and more of the education funding that is coming through that mechanism rather than through general funding sources, that we might see more of a disparity between high-income areas and low-income areas. In general, when we're talking about tax systems locally, you always get concerned if you have too much that you have to raise locally, that the areas with more resources will be able to raise more than the areas with lower incomes and lower wealth. But I'll ask Jeff if there's been any changes to equalization.
Welcome, Mr. Van Wyken, and if you could state your name and title again for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Van Wyken. I consulted with the budget project on their last decade report. The only thing I would add to what Nan pointed out is, and Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom could speak more to this point than I could, is that the equalization of referendum has diminished significantly as the allowance factors haven't been adjusted for inflation for nigh on to a decade now. And so the effectiveness of equalization has diminished significantly because of the frozen equalization factors.
Thank you very much. Then we have Ms. Representative Detmer and then Representative Benson. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Madden. On page 4 of your presentation, I think we all know that, you know, the poverty level is up, but in your data that you collected, what did you find that indicated the major causes of this?
Ms. Madden.
Representative Detmer, Madam Chair, are you asking what are the causes of raising poverty?
In your research, what came across as the major causes for the increase in poverty in Minnesota?
Ms. Madden.
That was a little outside the scope of our research. We know this is not an issue unique to Minnesota. Across the nation, this last economic recovery was a pretty weak one and actually fairly unprecedented in the sense that normally during an economic recovery, folks are better off at the end than at the beginning, but we actually did not make a lot of economic progress during the last economic recovery.
Thank you.
Representative Detmer, you're done.
Yeah.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just really not direct this question at the presenters, but at my colleagues here, two of my colleagues. One of the main things I think the final problem is that not everybody agrees with numbers. And until we get to the point where everyone will generally accept the numbers, in this case, from the Minnesota Budget Project, we then get into an ideological discussion. And at this point, I don't know if this is a good opportunity or not, but I would like to hear from other colleagues at the table whether or not these numbers seem credible. To me, they do. So I'm curious as to how others might respond.
I got an opinion on that.
Representative Brasloe, and did I see another hand? No, Representative
Brasloe. Madam Chair, thank you, and Representative Benson, I think we could probably spend the rest of the committee meeting going through the numbers, but I'll just highlight one number that I have a serious problem with in terms of its accuracy, and I'll cite the per $1,000 of personal income statistic that I see in here that I've seen in other reports, and I'll just give you an example of why this is a very inaccurate statistic, and that is between now and next year, we are going to see a collapse in personal income in the state. Maybe not because of our statewide policies, but certainly I think when we hear from Dr. Simpson later on and from others, there's a collapse in employment, income, and spending. So as a result of that, if we froze education spending with this collapse of personal income, we should see a dramatic increase in the amount of K-12 spending based on this statistic, based on $3,000 of personal income. And my guess is, if I went to the advocates of increased spending and asked them if that was good enough, they would say no. Using the very statistic they cite, they would say, well, no, that's an inaccurate statistic, because incomes are declining. So that's a number that I've always had a problem with in terms of spending, whether you base it off of Health and Human Services per income or any other area of government. So that's just my two cents. Since you asked for it.
And since Representative Benson asked for it, we'll give both Carols before we go back to our testifiers. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But I'm going to agree with my good colleague to the left, Representative Benson, because we do need to come to agreement on numbers. And a slideshow is not a way to come to agreement on numbers. There's a lot of information that's missing on these slides. Periodically, the definition of poverty changes, both at the federal level and at what the state decides is poverty. There are probably 15 different ways to measure inflation. Which one of the 15 measurements are being used in this report? So there's a whole lot of information that goes into these, and I know that each of these reports can be a week-long symposium, I suppose. But Representative Benson is absolutely right in talking to the committee about the numbers and about having coming to agreement on the numbers. We can't look at a slide and be so shallow as to say, this is gospel. We have to look more deeply into it. And I'm sure if at all possible when these reports are brought forward, if we can get complete copies of the reports, at least me, I'm not going to speak for anyone else. This one is? Okay. That's just one good. I'll take it. Right. But I see another one here where we don't have a complete copy. Right. But yeah, that would be helpful for me as a numbers guy.
Thank you, Ripton Biskins. And we know that you're a math teacher. And I said I was going to let the testifiers have a chance in between, and then we'll call on Representative Anzell, Representative Benson, and then we'll go to our next testifier. I don't know if it's Ms. Madden or Mr. Van Wyk.
Well, I guess I would like to respond in saying that we've tried to be very clear about our data sources in our report. It's good advice to put those data sources on a PowerPoint in the future. All the budget data is from the Department of Finance, which we adjusted for inflation using the IPD. So that's the measure of inflation related to government purchases. And the rankings data is census data. And we know some folks prefer to look at per capita, some percentage of income. We did provide both. I think I would just add that I would agree you never want to look at just one number and think that captures a very complex and rich story. But we've tried to be as transparent as possible in our data sources so you know where that information comes from and make your judgment on its quality.
Thanks very much, Mr. Van Wyk.
Madam Chair, just one observation. Representative Garofalo is correct that if our incomes are plummeting, then any government revenue as percentage of personal income will probably increase. And in the report, we're measuring the school current expenditures as a percentage of income relative to other states. And relative to other states, over time, Minnesota has fallen. There's reason to believe that relatively high personal income states should have higher expenditures insofar as they have higher labor costs than low-income states. That's supported by some work that's done by the research department of our Department of Revenue. Thank you
very much. And we've had similar figures to the ones that we have in front of us in publications like Education Week and so forth. So we're just trying to get the discussion going, I think, more than just questioning people's research samples. Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's fairly accurate to conclude that we, as a state, have plummeting property values as well. And plummeting property values, it seems to me, will speed up the inequality of public education if the slide toward less state support for public education and more dependence on local property taxes for education, factoring in that we're not all equal in terms of property values, that trend is, to me, is very disturbing. Is it your conclusion that a dependence on property taxes, that trend line, further speeds up a system of public education that becomes more unequal?
Ms. Madden.
Representative Anzell.
The answer is the most anything.
I apologize for that, Madam Chair. I think our research really suggests that we need to look at that question. It raises concerns for us.
Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I didn't want to open up the can of worms or Pandora box here with that original question, but I've been here 2 years, and often see these debates go on, and it's as if sometimes I have been living in a different dimension, almost. It seems to me that if we could come to some at least general understanding or agreement among ourselves as to where we really are in funding of education so we can move on, but we have a committee member of our colleagues who do not accept the statistics that are being presented by whether it's this group or some other, or, then I don't see how we ever reach consensus, and if there is a time in which the legislature in which consensus is going to be essential with these budget shortfall Councilman Robert Mallon's time, and that's the only reason I brought it up. So if I have created a problem for the chair, I apologize. But not really.
Representative Benson, do not apologize. And it's for this sort of discussion that we are having this hearing. So we welcome your question and the responses of Representative Garofalo, Representative Biskin, and anyone else. And there was one more hand that I didn't see before we conclude this section, and so I'm going to call on Representative Brown, and then we will conclude. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciated the question about equalization that Representative Jeffy asked, and I just was wondering if I could ask Mr. Strom to clarify that a little bit, just give us a little bit of history on whether or not we actually do have equalization here in the state.
I'm sure Mr. Strom would be happy to answer that, and I think he kind of touched on it at one of our earlier hearings and gave the answer you might want to hear again. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, two things have happened since over the last 15 years or so. One of those was in 2001 when the legislature eliminated the general education levy. We went from a system that had a very large equalized levy to a system that was all state aid. And so on the basic formula, a tax that raised a gross amount of about $1.3 billion was eliminated. That was a heavily equalized levy, and as a result, that equalization is gone, but what that equalization has been replaced with is state aid. However, for the other programs that Mr. Van Wyken mentioned, the debt service equalization and the operating referendum, the equalizing factors for those programs has not been changed in the last 15 years or so. And as tax base has grown over time, the aid provided as a percent of the total revenue under both of those programs has fallen fairly substantially.
Thank you, Mr. Strom.
Thank you.
Thank you to both of the testifiers very much.
Thank you very much.
Yep. And now we'll go to Angie Eiler from Growth and Justice, who has just arrived, so we'll give her a second to get her PowerPoint in order. Ms. Eilers is the Research and Policy Director for Growth and Justice, and she will update us on their work in education investments as well. And they did have a conference at the in St. Paul at the River Center last November. I know that Representative McFarlin was at it, and I was at it, and maybe others as well. So, welcome. Are you ready? And if so, I will call on you. All right, go ahead, Ms. Eilers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for inviting me to testify, and thank you, committee, for having the time to hear an investment proposal. At Growth and Justice, we begin with a rather perhaps ambitious or aggressive goal, and it is one that's linked to our economy. And I believe Dr. Stinson could articulate this more so. But education and the economy are inextricably linked. And it is, as I've heard Dr. Stinson say and many other economists, education is a chief driver to an economy. So our interest in Growth and Justice is to see economic growth coupled with economic justice. And in reaching economic growth in the future, we're looking at post-secondary attainment rates. Setting a goal of increasing by 50% the post-secondary attainment rate in Minnesota by the year 2020, with a particular attention given to students of color and Native Americans who have not benefited historically from post-secondary attainment, but who represent a growing population. And the reason we set this aggressive or ambitious post-secondary attainment rate is because I think many of you agree and would know that, it will become increasingly difficult for students in Minnesota to make a living wage beyond without something beyond high school. Students increasingly are going to need something more, a one-year or a two-year or a four-year degree. We're not talking about sending all kids to college, but at least half as many more are getting a post-secondary degree of some kind. Currently, where Minnesota students stand, and this snapshot is of the cohort of 24 to 35-year-olds who represent that cohort who just finished. In 2006, at least, where the data was collected, the combined rate of two-year degree and four-year degree holders is at about 52%. It's very difficult to capture the one-year degree holders who have professional certificates, that sort of thing. Many of those certificates are granted by private institutes like the Aveda Institute, that sort of thing. And I'm trying to work with the Office of Higher Ed to capture that figure of the number of students who have a one-year degree. But those who have a two- and a four-year degree is about 52%, one in two students. If we do nothing in the state of Minnesota, the state's demographer projects that that number will decrease to
about 25% who have a bachelor's degree and about 13% who have an associate's degree, for a combined rate of about 38%. That is moving us in absolutely the wrong direction for the future, as we know that we're moving toward a more competitive and globalized economy. And for students to have just a high school diploma, and seeing fewer students having something beyond high school will put us not in a position of economic growth, nor for them to take advantage of or contribute to. And this is related mostly to our demographic shifts, both socioeconomic and racial demographic shifts. The white population, which has proportionally benefited from and achieved at the post-secondary attainment rate levels, is projected to grow by the year 2030 by 7%. This is, again, the state demographer's data. Whereas the African-American population is projected to grow 152%, and the Hispanic-Latino population 270%, you can see the figures. This is going to be a shift in the population coming through the preschool and K-12 setting. And the message here is to particularly be more aggressive about providing access to and readiness for post-secondary attainment. In terms of reaching this goal of 50% increase, what this is going to mean is that for every 100 African-American students who have a post-secondary degree today, an additional 150 for a combined total of 250 African-American students will need to get a post-secondary degree. For Hispanic Latinos, for every 100 who have a degree today, an additional 275, for a total of 375, will need to obtain a post-secondary degree if we're to hit that 50% attainment goal. So you can see that the rate of attainment is going to be significantly increased from our race populations. The question that we pose to ourselves is how best to invest. We're addressing this very holistically, recognizing that today's three-year-old is tomorrow's third grader. I know it's very compelling to hear the early childhood evidence and the campaign on early childhood, and it would seem it would be enough to just invest in early childhood. But readying children for the K-12 system without taking on the needs and the issues in K-12 setting would truncate those early investments made in early childhood, and we probably wouldn't get the best bang for our buck in the long run. Rather, we're looking at all of the systems across the sectors from birth to college in our investment proposal. And what that means specifically is, and I'll just tell you how we mapped out this two-year study that we've undertaken. If we started at the far end and the finishing point, and the post-secondary attainment rate increase, we know from the research and the literature that in order for students to enroll and survive and finish a post-secondary degree, they need to be more and more prepared in their high school curriculum. We also know from the No Child Left Behind Act and from state statutes that students by the year 2013, 2014 are going to have to take more and more rigorous coursework, Algebra 2, Chemistry and Physics, other science courses. We also know that from the literature that a student who has proficient in their mathematical reasoning skills is more likely to take and pass and survive rigorous coursework. Also in the statute in the No Child Left Behind Act, Minnesota students will have to take and pass Algebra 1 now in the 8th grade, which is earlier than they have been currently. And as well, and I'm sorry for the graphic mix-up, I prepared this on a Macintosh. 3rd graders will, by the year 2013, have to take and will be reading at or above the 3rd grade level by the end of their 3rd grade. And that, again, is not only important from a statute perspective, but you know from cognition and a variety of other developmental literature that a child who's reading at the 3rd grade is well prepared for taking on mathematical reasoning and other coursework and meeting or going beyond the proficiency levels. And you know that reading is the gateway to all other learning. Now, while those blue highlighted bubbles are in statutes on either end in the bookends, these are not necessarily, there's no compulsory attendance laws that say all kids have to go on to post-secondary ed, but it is economically demonstrated that beyond high school, which is a contribution to their individual prosperity and to our state's prosperity. There's also no statute that says all kids have to come to kindergarten ready to learn, but again, I think we know from the research and conventional wisdom now that for every child who comes to kindergarten ready to learn, they're more likely to be reading by the 3rd grade, to be sure.
So we're looking at it, obviously, very comprehensively from even the prenatal care perspective, the kinds of early childhood efforts and interventions that are made well before a child enters kindergarten, all the way to their finishing rates in post-secondary. So what we did with this particular map is ask ourselves, where do Minnesota's students stand on each of these key essential benchmarks? There are a variety of data sources out there, graduation rates, enrollment rates in rigorous coursework, including AP and ID, that sort of thing, the MCA scores. We relied actually on the NAEP scores, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, for a few reasons. One's been a more stable measure. The MCA has been a measure that's been shifting over time. It's only been in place for the last 2 years, so it hasn't been a stable measure. And we think the NAEP scores are more reflective of the rigorous proficiency level. So we asked, where are our students on each of these outcomes? And we tracked the number of students who are not on track or not at the proficiency level that's going to correlate with their likeliness of succeeding at the next level. And so then we asked ourselves, okay, for those students who are off track, what does the literature tell us? What do best practices tell us about the most effective interventions that are going to disrupt that downward track? What is going to put these students on track that's been proven effective, not only in a case study setting or in one district, but rather it's been replicated across the state, has been through rigorous review using showing a decent effect size. And finally, we put ourselves through an even more strict filter, which is to ask, of those interventions that are proven effective, what are the most cost-effective interventions? And even when we prepared this a year or two ago, we were concerned with Minnesota's budget. You can imagine we're more concerned today, as you are. Just a snapshot of where our students are on some key measures. I know in Minnesota we're accustomed to seeing students in the 80% and 90% achievement rate. Unfortunately, this represents those students who are not proficient. These are NAEP scores at the 4th and 8th grade reading level, disaggregated by race. I'd like to provide another slide disaggregated by socioeconomic status when I get a chance, but the take-home message here is that there are a number of students who are not on track in their reading proficiency to take and pass rigorous coursework. The numbers don't look too different for math proficiency. NAEP, 4th and 8th grade NAEP scores are also alarming in terms of the number of students who are not proficient. And what you might notice here is that I put the number of students who did not graduate. One would think that the proficiency rate would sort of match the fact that students graduated or didn't graduate. Turns out many students are graduating, which is a good thing, but they're not graduating with proficiency levels. So ideally, we would see our graduation exit requirement showing that our students are highly proficient in reading and math. And that's showing up in our post-secondary enrollment level of remediation. So in other words, those high school graduation requirements are a bit lower than our post-secondary enrollment requirements, and what the Minsky system and the University of Minnesota's system is seeing is a 34% remediation rate. And what's troubling about that is that that's expensive. It's expensive not only to the student who has to take an additional year in post-secondary school. It costs them an additional year of tuition, more loans that they have to take out. But it's also very costly to the system. I think many of you know that it's in the tens of millions of dollars to remediate students once they do enroll. And I know the P16 Council, headed by Commissioner Shegan and President Brunick and Chancellor McCormick, are addressing that alignment between graduation requirements and enrollment requirements, and that's something we really ought to do because it's frankly expensive to have the misalignment. So our task before that we took on, and in the front cover of the report, which I, sorry, did not provide to everybody, but we are a nonprofit, we're trying to save money. I can make this available to you, but we have a statewide study committee.
Ms. Eilers, we better give one to Representative Diskins after the meeting.
We did send them around to all committee members, and I'm being frugal about not handing them out again, but I'd be happy to respond to your request if you'd like even more than one.
Thank you.
Yes, but at any rate, we posed to our 25-member steering committee, which is made up, by the way, of early childhood folks, K-12 folks, higher ed, as well as rural, urban, some business community representatives, parents, folks from the social sector, And obviously these are competing stakeholders, right? But we brought them together and asked them to transcend their sectoral differences and try to keep their eye on Minnesota students, which they gladly did as they engaged in this process for 18 months with us. What we asked them to do is to ask themselves specifically, if we know where our students are off track and we know what's going to be effective and cost effective, let's make some decisions about where we would best invest our next Minnesota dollar. And we were guided by key principles, and these principles, I would argue, are if nothing else, if I leave no other impression up here today or in the future, it's that that these investment principles be kept in mind whenever allocation decisions are being made for education. The first is that that decisions are made comprehensively, in other words, addressing all the students' educational needs, the early childhood needs, K-12 needs, and higher ed needs, and that those investments have compound effect. In other words, when a child is readied for kindergarten, that readiness is sustained in their K-12 years, and that readiness is sustained through higher ed. I know it's difficult to select our children, so let's just think of them as comprehensively as possible. And addressing the whole child, not only their cognitive needs or academic achievement needs, but there are many social and financial barriers that are keeping our students from succeeding in the school systems, the various educational systems. Our third principle is that we think smart investments are made to address students where they're at. In other words, identifying those students who are lacking a certain proficiency, because once they're off track, and there's not any disruption to put them on track, they will stay off track. Gaps start early and they only widen over time. And then finally, to make our investments accountably, that is to show the intended effects. In other words, why would we spend money on something if we don't know that it's going to work? But then that we pay for them for these things fairly. All told, we have a portfolio that calls for about $1 billion of new spending, new investment annually in Minnesota students from early childhood to higher ed. And we kind of buck convention here by transcending the traditional sectoral boundaries. We like to think of early childhood as being from birth to 8 years old, or the end of third grade, when a child is reading and reading well. And the investment we think that will get us to the point where all students are reading by the end of third grade is about a $405 million investment. What that would include is increasing the prenatal care access. Right now, Minnesota ranks 27th in the nation in terms of access to prenatal care. That is one of those early steps in a child's development that should be taken care of. Second, to expand quality child care. Again, this is something that is, quality is afforded to those who can buy the best. But if we can expand access to quality child care and have children in the hands of quality child care providers, we're setting them on the road for greater success.
Ms. Tyler, just so you can budget your time, we're going to go to Mr. Stinson at 10:02, and we do want to have time for questions.
Okay. I'll just quickly point out that we're talking about another $255 million to ready students for higher learning. You know, already Minnesota invests quite handsomely in curriculum and instruction and assessment. That's not where we're asking for new investments to be made, but rather to support academic rigor and social supports to keep students in and surviving academic rigorous coursework. And this could come in any number of ways. And we do have infrastructure in place in Minnesota when it comes to academic rigor, such as advanced placement courses in IB coursework and post-secondary enrollment options. But only half of Minnesota's high schools offer AP. We would like to see that advanced placement or its equivalents be offered to all high schools. Post-secondary enrollment option, unfortunately, is only being taken advantage by 19% of Minnesota students, and only 2% of those students are students of color. So we'd like to see more enrollment or dual enrollment of some kind where the post-secondary and the secondary systems are knitting their programs together so that all students have access to rigorous coursework. But importantly, and the research points this out very vividly, that to ratchet up the rigor in high school is one thing, but to provide sort of social supports to keep them in and surviving rigorous coursework is a whole other matter. That comes in the form of tutoring and mentoring, school counseling. I think, Minnesota ranks the worst in the nation at 792 students for every school counselor. The national average is 488 counselors for every student.
And we're not talking about only in-school, or only K-12 budgets for that matter. Out-of-school time is a very important period. In students, about 40% of Minnesota students spend time outside of their home or outside of the school. That could be viewed as an opportunity, or we've often seen where it's a time of when students get off track. We'd like to see that Minnesota students are provided more and more out-of-school opportunities in the form of mentoring and counseling and academic opportunities. Dropout and pregnancy prevention is an intervention that is a low cost, but sets a student up, on the road to avoid poverty. When a student drops out of high school, they're most certainly on a road to poverty. We want to keep more and more of our students in school. Minnesota has nearly 10,000 students dropping out of high school every year for a cost of $10 billion over the course of the lifetime of that cohort each year. On the other hand, for every student who graduates from high school, we should say thank you. They contribute $1 million over the course of their lifetime in terms of taxable wages and less reliance on social assistance. Of course, we want to see all of our students finish high school. But we need to expand our access opportunities to post-secondary. Once more and more students are academically prepared and socially ready for post-secondary, we should be able to afford them the opportunity to even afford it. Minnesota is considered a high tuition but a moderate aid state when it comes to need-based aid or state grants. We really encourage the state to consider expanding need-based aid. We're increasingly seeing middle-class families not able to afford the Minnesota higher education system, and to keep them out of this rich asset that we've developed in our state would be an economic loss to these individuals and certainly to the state. This is a spreadsheet of sorts that I can make available to you and talk at greater length if you're interested, but you can see that we've basically broken down a variety of interventions, multiplied the cost of the intervention times the number of thousands of students who are currently not on track to succeed at higher rates and to achieve higher attainment, and the sum total of this is $1 billion.
Thank you very, very much, Representative Detmer, and then Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the filers. The one chart on the first page, the third, we're actually the on the bottom, on the left, in terms of by 2020, a smaller proportion of Minnesota will have post-secondary education. Now, I've just toured two of my Minsky institutions. They're basically at the seams. So is there going to be a drop-off by 2020 in terms of students that are going on to college, second post-secondary, whether it's technical schools or entering the military and getting their education and so forth?
Thank you, Silas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I can't extrapolate from those two schools how that translates across the state. I'm relying on state demographers' data, which is a statewide figure.
Madam Chair. And so what you're saying is statewide, there's going to be less number of students going on to post-secondary?
Well, we won't have a diminishment of the number of students. We are seeing a shift in the student population. So historically speaking, the students who have gone on to obtain a post-secondary degree have generally been higher income or middle income students from families with middle or higher income and white students. That student population is shrinking, and the ability to afford higher education is shrinking. Therefore, in order to get more students who have not traditionally been enrolling in and staying in post-secondary school in at the great increased rates proportional to these sorts of numbers, if we do nothing to for those students who haven't traditionally gone, then we will see a backslide in the number who finish. In other words, we need to provide academic, social, and financial supports to those students who have not been going to and finishing a post-secondary degree at much higher rates than we have in the past.
Representative Adams.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Eilers, I appreciate the research and the way you've presented the information, and I guess particularly your emphasis on the changing demographics of Minnesota's student body, getting that in front of us so that we can see it clearly. And when I look at your investment slides and the way that you kind of violate the silos that we work in here, there's a good challenge to us there. I'm not optimistic that we're going to be making a lot of investments this year. particularly when we look across the silos. You know, the governor proposed some investments in K-12, but without data, it's not clear, given that he also proposed cutting revenues to the state, where the money for the increased investments is going to come from. And it may well come from other silos. How do we then take, how could we then take your investment proposal and instead use it as a guideline for wrestling the deficit down?
Thank you for the question, Representative Gavney. You know, knowing that these interventions, these programs work for kids and are very effective at keeping them on track and above proficiency at, and that they are cost effective, suggests to me that we would ask not only why not invest in these interventions, but at the very least, why cut them? If we know these are the things that work for students, shouldn't they be protected? So I hope this, at the minimum, can serve as a guide. Beyond that, I think we do need to be creative in terms of violating silos and categorical areas and think more holistically about students.
Pardon us, Doctor.
I don't get it either, so. Oh, now I get it.
Madam Chair, they don't like looking at the back of my head. I don't understand it.
Now I get it. It's nothing that I can
move Deborah's head.
I'm sorry, Ms. Eilers. Please continue.
We'll get back there.
That's fine. I recognize your challenge. I absolutely recognize your challenge. And not only that challenge.
Okay, members, we're going to go on. It's enough for you, Representative. We're going to go on to Representative Ward and then Representative Anderson. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Eilers, I've read the report.
Thank you.
And I received it, a month ago or 6 months ago, six weeks ago, 8 weeks ago. And I actually called my superintendent and said, you need to get hold of this. And you need to look at it. And Representative Abney, as we look at reform, this report is the one thing that really has excited me about a comprehensive plan. I mean, a total comprehensive plan. And I think, I continue to hear oftentimes, how far are we behind? How much is enough? How much do we need for education? And I continue to hear from, well-researched help from Parents United and CE organizations that have done research, $1 billion, about 20% $1 billion. But your report lays out exactly, in my opinion, the revenue investments to look at a good comprehensive reform package. So I encourage all members, just like Representative Biskin talked about, get the full report and read it and share it with your superintendents, because tied with the Minnesota Miracle and this report, I think holds some real promise and optimism. So I want to thank you for what you've done.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Ward. We'll take that as a statement, and we'll go to Representative Anderson and then back to Ms. Eilers for the final word, and we've got about 2 minutes. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Curious to know if you think it's realistic to expect every Minnesota student to pass a physics class, for example, to graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Eilers.
Thank you, Chairman Riley and Representative. I've been working with her four children in paid and unpaid capacities my entire professional life and even before that. And I absolutely am optimistic about what human beings can learn and can do, given the right conditions. Can all students take and pass physics? You bet. And I think we should give them that opportunity. To not provide them that opportunity and to arm them with all the skills to be able to acquire that is to close a window or a door for them. And I, as an educator, wouldn't want to be the person who stood in front of them. So absolutely, I believe all children can achieve great things.
And Ms. Eilers, any concluding statement?
Only that the fact that we have framed this proposal through an economic lens. We've asked, what can we reasonably afford in this state? And when we afford ourselves the kind of quality of life that we expect of ourselves, we should be able to pay for it and pay for it fairly. But we understand Minnesota taxpayers and voters' concerns with accountability, and we tried to demonstrate that when we're going to spend the Minnesota taxpayers' dollars, we should do it with an outcome that is tied to a goal that is that reaches the kind of outcomes that need to happen and are demonstrated with research and even-handed review of the literature, and that the dividends that Minnesota could see from this investment pays off well into the future. While it may be painful to invest in ourselves now, it's an asset that has historically and economically paid off handsomely for decades, and it would be a pity to underinvest and shortchange ourselves for the future.
Thank you very much. Dr. Stinson. I think everybody knows Dr. Stinson, but in case there's one person that doesn't, he is our state economist and also a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Applied Economics, and we all look to him, I think, for reliable information. So we're honored to have him here as a follow-up to our talk at the Free Institute yesterday to all legislators. We look forward to what he might have to say on education. Welcome, Dr. Stinson, and of course, please identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chairman, my name is Tom Stinson. I'm a professor in the Department of Applied Economics at the University of Minnesota. And I also serve as a state economist. I suppose I should move a little closer to the microphone here now that I think everything is straightened out. Is that right? This is an unusual experience for me. I'm not an expert on educational finance or educational technology or anything like that. And it's also a little bit unusual for me to be asked about anything any longer than what's going to happen in the next forecast. But today I'm going to talk about longer-term economic issues. And I'm going to talk about them in a little more general way. These longer-term issues are important to the long-term welfare of the state. And the long-term issue that I want to talk about in particular is Minnesota's investment into education. And I'm going to start out by telling a quick story which most of you have probably heard more than once and probably even more than twice, but it's still a useful story, and that is the story of Minnesota's economic progress over the last 40-plus years. In the 1960s, Minnesota per capita personal income, which most economists would argue is the best measure of economic well-being, standard of living, quality of life, whatever you want to call it, the easy things that we have that we can measure, that's probably the best measure. We were at 95% of the U.S. average. We ranked 25th as a state. Now we're at 106% of the U.S. average. We ranked 12th or 13th as a state. A few years ago, we were even better. We were at 109% of the U.S. average. We ranked 6th or 7th as a state. And a few years ago, I was curious why? What's behind this outstanding performance? Because all states didn't do that. If they would have done that, we wouldn't have moved up in ranking. We moved up in ranking enormously compared to other states. So the question is why? And I did some analysis of that, and what I found was part of it was due to the fact that Minnesotans are a little bit more fully employed than people in other states, that we have a greater percentage of the workforce, people in the workforce age actually working. I found that female participation in the labor force in particular was a lot higher, and so that gave us a little boost. If you looked at the other side, though, the business investment side, what you found was that the amount of physical capital that we had in the state hadn't grown any faster than the U.S. average, and actually might have grown a little more slowly than the U.S. average over the period that I was looking at. And so that didn't explain it. It wasn't that we had more big fancy machines in the state to grind stuff out or anything like that. And after looking at all this, the one thing that I was left with was that the explanation as to why we did so much better than the U.S. average over an extended period of time was the quality of the Minnesota workforce. And there's a simple pairing of numbers that gives you some ideas to what's gone on there. In the 1960s, less than half of the workforce had a high school diploma. Now, more than 91% of the workforce has a high school diploma. So there is some relationship between education and quality of workforce and economic growth, not necessarily just economic success by the individual, but economic growth for the entire state. And that leads me to the first slide that I want to talk to you a little bit about, and that's economic facts of life. And again, this isn't anything new to some of you. You've probably seen Tom Gillespie and I talk about this, but these are economic facts of life. And the first economic fact of life is that our overall standard of living in the state depends upon output per resident, the amount of stuff that we make, the amount of services we provide per resident. And you can get more output in one of two ways. You can get more output by having more people working, or you can get more people, more output by having the people working making more per hour. And economic fact of life here, 1C, is if the ratio of workers to residents declines, productivity is going to need to increase if we're just going to stay even, if we're going to maintain our current standard of living. And if you look at the demographics, the ratio of individuals working to individuals either in their pre-work years or the retired individuals is going to increase. This is a slide, again, that you've seen before, and people are always attracted to the top end of the slide, but what we see is that people are getting older. But the important thing is to look at the lower end of the slide, and there what you see is the people that are entering the workforce, we're getting fewer of those. And that's important. Retirement is going to be greater than people working in to moving into the workforce. You can say, well, that's not a problem. Why don't we just hire them from other states? It's not just a Minnesota phenomenon. Here you can see that it's a national phenomenon. The number of people in the 18 to 24s is going to decline both nationally and in Minnesota, and so it's going to be much more difficult to hire individuals. The implication of all this, very simply, is that labor force growth is about to slow, and it's about to slow fairly sharply. Between 1990 and 2000, labor force grew at a 1.5% rate. Between 2010 and 2015, we'll grow about half that fast. Between 2020 and 2030, it's going to grow about 0.1% per year. This is just noise. This is background activity is all. And of course, dependent upon a whole set of assumptions, particularly about migration to the state, that may not come true. The bottom line to all of this is that workforce development is going to be crucial to Minnesota's future. It's going to be important to have be able to maintain and grow our workforce, but the real key to growth in the state's economy looking out in the future is going to be productivity, and the way that we have more productivity is going to be higher quality workers. It's not just a Minnesota issue, it's a global issue. There's an article in The Economist a couple of years ago that highlighted this. But, you know, the problem is that people think about this search for talent as a search for the best and the brightest, and it's going to be much more than a search for the best and the brightest. We're going to need to maximize the use of the talents of everybody that's of working age and expand the number of people in working age as well. Skilled workers at all levels, not just PhD physicists, but people that are going to work on the factory floor, they are going to be the scarce resource. The labor force is not going to grow at the rate that we've been used to seeing, and we're going to need to work on the other part of the equation, the productivity side. And that's led Tom Gillespie and me to make this statement that the three most important parts, the three most important factors for future economic success are productivity, productivity, and productivity. And the way that we get productivity is going to be important. We're going to have to focus on all the ways that we can get productivity. We can get productivity by having more investment in plant and equipment, newer plant and equipment. But we also need to focus on the productivity gains that we can get from improving the stock of human capital, from investing in individuals, from investing in education. We're going to have to invest in infrastructure, and we're going to have to invest in the research and development to advance technology. Yesterday at the retreat, it was put another way and said that productivity is more than just searching out lower cost solutions. It's figuring out ways to make existing products better so that you get a price premium because the product is going to last longer. And it's also figuring out ways to make better products, to find that value added, that new value added product that you're going to make use of. Productivity is important. Productivity is going to be vital to the future of this state, and the question is, how do we get it? And we go back to what made Minnesota special, what made Minnesota overachieve compared to the rest of the country, and clearly education, K-12 education in particular, is going to be increasingly important. That's where we're going to have to devote resources in order to build up the state's economy. And that leads to the last point, and this is a point that both of the prior speakers have made as well. That is something that's disappointing and doesn't augur well for the future. And that is, if education is the key to productivity, and I believe it is the key to productivity, what are we doing, how well are we doing looking on out to the future? And here, remember that I said at the start of this talk that 91% of people in the workforce, 16 to 64, have a high school diploma. If you look at this, and this is some material that the state demographer prepared, now we're only seeing 85%. And if you look at American Indians, the Hispanics, and the blacks, you see high school graduation rates. And I know that you all know this already, but at around 60%. Given that those groups are the groups that we are seeing the largest increase in over time, that's just a concern that I have looking on out to the future and the future economic growth in this state. Madam Chairman, that concludes my remarks. I'd be glad to answer questions at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Stinson. And members, we did not invite our demographer, Gillespie, even though we would have loved to have had both of them, but we focused, as returning members know, on the achievement gap last year. So we had a lot of the information about the subgroups that aren't doing as well on graduation rates and other measures. So being that we have the huge deficit, we're talking finances, we wanted to focus on Dr. Stinson today, and since there's no one on the list, I will ask the first question, and if you do have a question, be sure to get on the list. Dr. Stinson, you mentioned that K-12 in particular, and that it's increasingly important to invest in education as the key to productivity. Now that we have a $7 billion deficit, do you still recommend investing in education somewhat even while we solve the deficit? I'm looking at the federal government with their stimulus package, and you know they are certainly salting money around even in the face of the deficit. Here in Minnesota, where we have to balance the budget, are you saying even this year that we should do some investing in education?
Madam Chair, first I want to say that while you may think that we have a $7 billion deficit, I hope we do not.
Dr. Stinson, so do I, but yeah. You know from our conversation yesterday, I'm just predicting what I think, counting inflation and counting things getting worse. But every time you say maybe we won't, I feel better. So, Dr. Stinson.
Maybe we will, too, but I don't want to be down. but I certainly hope that we don't have it. You, Madam Chair, you and the rest of the legislature face a really difficult set of decisions looking on out into the future of here the next 4 months or whatever as to what you cut, how you cut things, how you get back so that we're back in balance. And you there, Jolie, yesterday said you have to think about priorities. What's important, what's most important, and pare back on things that are less important. Tom Gillespie and I yesterday said that you have to think about what the state is particularly well positioned to do, not what we would like to be able to do, but what we're particularly well positioned to do and what's important to the state. When I look at those two criteria, it seems to me that education is the place that both is the highest priority and that the state is particularly well positioned to do. If you look at healthcare is an important problem, but it's not clear to me that the state can solve healthcare problems by itself. It seems to me that that may be more of a federal problem that has to be solved nationally as opposed to at the state level. That said, I'm not optimistic about finding large amounts of money for funding education, for funding increases in education. It seems to me that you have to go back and use those same priorities, the same priority and what's the state positioned to do well in thinking about reallocating funds within the educational programs that we have now. And that you may or may not be able to get additional funding, but you may be able to find ways of reallocating, moving things from within the silo, basically, around so that you get more money to the items that are most important, that, that you as a committee feel are most important in moving education forward in the state.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Simpson, for your always excellent engagement with us. I actually have one question, but that kind of triggered another question for me. I'll just throw two things very quickly. One is, when I last engaged with you, you had sort of counseled back to a number of us to also be thinking about, right now what's happening is that, you know, there's a lot of stress and tension, obviously, in terms of this biennial budget. However, one of the things you pointed out to us was that, you know, decisions we make now in a K-12 or even an E-12 system are 12, 13, 14-year, you know, decisions. In other words, my child will be entering, you know, kindergarten this year in a system that's supported by whatever decision I make with this fiscal biennial issue. And that has everything to do with what's going to happen when he's expected to exit the system in 12th grade. And so I just wanted you to perhaps, you know, sort of, you know, do that wisdom thing with us, because in terms of, you know, helping us to think about how do we approach our work in that way. You've been around with us for a long time. I don't think it's any secret that we tend to think primarily in sort of two-year bursts, and every once in a while I think we're able to step outside of that. How can we best do that? And then another sort of quick unrelated question has to do with, so I guess this issue that, you know, so well, you know, maybe kind of all you can do right now is you know, do some reallocating, you know, across silos. But is there a danger that we wind up perhaps staying in that mode? And how do we stay focused, or how can we avoid staying in that mode and kind of keep our eyes on the prize in terms of what do we need to do beyond the quick fix? So just some sort of, you know, ideas.
Dr. Simpson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I'm not sure I remember all of your questions and so on like that, so let me try and talk about the last thing that that you addressed first. And your concern is how do we keep from getting caught so that you're in a no-growth situation, extended no-growth situation. And I think my experience in the time that I've been around is that if there's additional money shows up, it does get spent. And so I think that the real issue is will the economy recover, and if the economy recovers, what do we do with that additional money, and how do we meet that? And you know, I'm optimistic. I think that there will be money after we get this budget situation worked through. Now, to the extent that you don't solve the problem fully in 2010-2011, it doesn't just magically go away in 2012-2013. Mm-hmm. As you found out for 2008-2009, if you leave $1 billion, a structural deficit of $1 billion for 2010-2011, you know, when we next do the forecast, that $1 billion structural deficit is still there, and in this case it grew. And so you have to solve the problem as much as you can, as quickly as you can. I think that's a key in order to get growth going on. Now, another part of your question, another thing, you said cross-silo subsidization. You know, I really think, again, that you need to think about within the silo, moving things around within the silo as well, and think about what's your highest priority within the K-12 area, and where are you best positioned to make a difference. And here this gets to the question that you were asking about the long term. Mm-hmm. It's important to figure out a way to get people to have higher graduation rates. But if the solution is something that has 13 years or 14 years or 15 years pre-K kinds of activities, then we're going to lose a generation, basically. Mm-hmm. And so in your setting of priorities, it's important to improve it at the start, but you need to be thinking what kinds of programs are going to make a difference for people that are in the 8th grade or the 9th grade or the 10th grade that will help them push over and actually graduate, because we can't go through 10 or 12 or 15 years with 50 or 60% graduation rates for American Indians and Blacks and Latino. And so that's the little bit of economic educational policy that I know, but I can see that if you don't do something that has some more immediate impact, and you just work at those that are entering, we're in for 15 years of disappointing growth in the quality of the workforce.
Thank you, Dr. Stinson. We're out of time, and I'll just say to members, I think Representative Mariani's question was reprioritizing across silos, but I think I heard Dr. Stinson say, as he said, prioritize within our silo. And so that would say to me, members, that when we look at the governor's budget, we may not want to take from other silos for our committee as much as we might want to reprioritize within our own silo if there's wreck and ruin in other silos. And so that's what I think Growth and Justice was telling us, too, that there were other silos that make a difference with education that aren't necessarily within our budget. And we have to look at the whole child. I also heard that despite the fact that it's very important that we look at early childhood, the size of our deficit and the productivity problems that we are having, that we older kids need to be sure to be addressed here and not just forget about them and go straight to early childhood. So we're going to also send Dr. Stinson over to the Senate, I think, and make sure that they end up with a balanced recommendation, as I hope that we do, as I hope we do in the House. We'll send him everywhere. And so thank you so much to all of our testifiers. I think it helped to lay out where we are and what the deficits are and how we've been investing in our students. And I think that no matter how you slice it and dice it, Representative Rothwell, we have to know that we have been not quite keeping up our end of the ship, and that it is important to solving the deficit and the productivity. So I look forward to working with all of you about those ideas, and the meeting's adjourned.